His father taught literature at Brigham Young University, while his brother and three sisters all graduated from the school. This was supposed to be Valentine's path, too. He would finish high school, go on a mission, a 2-year voluntary stint devoted to proselytizing and humanitarian aid work, and then return home to attend BYU and a life spent serving his church. Until that baseball game got in the way. To understand what happened to Valentine during that game, we need to understand that Mormons believe the Holy Ghost can enter a person during prayer. The feeling of spirit entering you, explains Valentine, what Mormons call the feeling of the Holy Ghost, is the very center of the religion. And it's a real sensation, a burning in the bosom that becomes a deeply joyful sense of peace and connection to something much greater than yourself. Yet there was absolutely no reason that Valentine should have rounded first base and bumped into the Holy Ghost. There is nothing particularly sacred about baseball. It didn't make any sense, he explains. I was a spiritual kid. I'd had plenty of experiences when the Spirit entered me, but all of them took place in church, while praying, not on a baseball field. It was incredibly confusing. I mean, as far as I knew, the Holy Ghost didn't really play baseball. His confusion triggered a brief crisis of faith. But the real trouble showed up later that same year, when Valentine picked up a guitar. When I started playing, I also started having these crazy peak experiences, he explains. Music was a direct pipeline into another world. And the feeling I got was exactly like the feeling of the Holy Ghost. The same feeling I bumped into rounding first base, only much more powerful. I would get sucked into these intense trances that would last for hours. I'd get so lost that drool would pour out of my mouth. I wouldn't even notice. And maybe the Holy Spirit was okay with baseball, but rock and roll? That was just totally out of bounds. But everything that's happened since, my whole career, has been an attempt to chase this feeling. The pale that Valentine ventured beyond, call it the pale of the church, is an age-old barrier for the spiritually curious. It's a divide between those who believe that direct access to God should be moderated by a learned elite and those who believe direct access should be available to anyone at any time. Top-down versus bottom-up. Ecstasy in small doses, metered out by those in charge, is a time-honored technique for social bonding and bureaucratic control. But ecstasy from a fire hose, filling anyone who asks with vibrant certainty, never mind the doctrine, that's downright dangerous. In Christianity, it shows up as the tension between chapter and verse Roman Catholics and holy rolling Pentecostals. In Islam, it's solemn imams versus twirling Sufis. In China, it's by-the-book Confucians against go-with-the-flow Taoists. In each case, a small community figures out a more direct path to knowledge, and because they blossom without the sanction of the orthodoxy, they are persecuted for it. Spiritual subcultures that slip through heaven's gate tend to piss off the gatekeepers. In Valentine's case, once he realized the church wasn't his only access to the Holy Ghost, his dependence on organized religion dwindled. By the time he was 16, he told his father he wasn't going on a mission. By the time he was 18, he had left home for a life in rock and roll. But none of this was easy. The pale of the church had a real hold on me, admits Valentine. I was terrified to venture beyond it. I had no real idea what was going to happen. Compared to many who came before him, Valentine got off lightly. Historically, we denounce these seekers in the strongest terms available. Consider Joan of Arc, the medieval French peasant girl who heard angels and led her nation to victory in the Hundred Years' War. She won battles, restored a king, and shook Europe's political, military, and religious structures to their core. But because she was an unordained woman claiming to know God's will, she found herself on the wrong side of the pale of the church, with tragic consequences. At her trial for heresy, church officials denied her a lawyer, stacked the jury against her, and sent death threats to the judge. Then they tried to trap her with an impossible question. Do you believe you experience the grace of God? If she answered no, then she'd be admitting that the voices she heard were diabolical, not divine, and she would have to die for it. If she answered yes, that she definitely knew she was in God's grace, then she'd have violated one of the core tenets of their doctrine, and she would have to die for it. Joan dodged both responses elegantly. If I am not in a state of grace, may God put me there, and if I am, may God so keep me. She evaded the legalistic trap set for her, and at the same time affirmed her blameless faith. Those who were interrogating her, the court notary remarked, were stupefied. But even that inspired testimony was not enough to save her young life. The presiding bishop replaced the nuns who should have been guarding her with soldiers who tried to rape her instead. Joan put men's breeches on to protect her honor, and then tied all of her leggings, hose, and tunic together in a kind of jury-rigged chastity belt. The bishop seized the moment, condemning her for the lesser charge of cross-dressing as heresy. She had stolen fire, and, the church insisted, she'd die by it. They had her burned at the stake 3 times over, and so no one could gather a relic, dumped her ashes into the Seine. The pale of the church is why, despite millennia of bold experimentation, the insights of mystics rarely survive. Their beliefs are ridiculed and their motives maligned. Lest anyone try to follow in their footsteps, the recipes for ecstasy are torn to pieces and scattered to the wind. Even when religions are built on the epiphanies of their founders, attempts to repeat those original experiments are strongly discouraged. It's one of the main reasons we fail to notice the possibilities of non-ordinary states. The pale of the church has been blocking our view. The pale of the body. In the late 1990s, University of Edinburgh philosopher Andy Clark was researching cyborgs when he realized we were closer to that man-machine merger than anyone wanted to admit. If you have a pacemaker, cochlear implant, or even a pair of eyeglasses, you're using technology to upgrade biology. What Clark found strange was that no one seemed to notice these developments. Type cyborg into a search bar, and the first thing that pops up is a fictional or hypothetical person whose physical abilities are extended beyond normal human limitations by mechanical elements. But there's nothing fictional about eyeglasses or smartphones, or, for that matter, artificial hearts and bionic limbs. So why, Clark wanted to know, haven't we acknowledged that we're already becoming cyborgs? What he realized is that we are confined by a cultural assumption, call it the pale of the body, that ranks the stuff we are, biology, above the stuff we make, technology. It is the prejudice that whatever matters about my mind, Clark explains in his book, Natural Born Cyborgs, depends solely on what goes on inside my biological skin bag, inside the ancient fortress of skin and skull. We have trouble admitting we're cyborgs then, because the very prospect of augmenting ourselves with technology seems suspect. And the skin bag bias extends beyond tools that augment our bodies to techniques that enhance our minds. In 2012, a study conducted by the American Pediatric Association found that 1 out of 5 Ivy League college students was taking smart drugs to help improve academic performance. By 2015, that number had jumped to 1 in 3 in all college students. Almost immediately, there was a backlash. You might think the backlash was about safety. After all, the term smart drug applies to the unsupervised and often dangerous off-label use of ADHD drugs like Ritalin and Adderall. But public health wasn't the issue. Instead, in November 2015, USA Today, Washington Post, and a half dozen other major news outlets all asked the same question: are smart drugs cheating? It's a peculiar question. Students use these drugs because they improve focus and help them work longer and harder. It's the same thing a cup of coffee and a study group provides. But gatherings of caffeinated co-eds aren't considered cheating. So what makes smart drugs any different? Or consider our distrust of a more controversial class of smart drugs, psychedelics. 70 years ago, the influential University of Chicago historian Mircea Eliade coined the phrase archaic techniques of ecstasy to describe singing, dancing, chanting, and meditation, or all the original and pure techniques the shamans used to alter consciousness. But he left out an important category. While shamans on nearly every continent have long utilized psychotropic plants like mushrooms and cacti to shift states and access insight, Eliade omitted this fact, editing history to come down on the side of the skin bag. Narcotics, he argued in his classic book, Shamanism, are only a vulgar substitute for pure trances, an imitation of a state that the shaman is no longer capable of attaining otherwise. So whether we're talking about students popping pills or shamans taking psychedelics, the bias is the same. It's a question of effort. Studying all night for an exam takes work. Adderall feels like cheating. The same goes for grueling hours of drumming, chanting, and meditation versus the near-certain transformation produced by mind-altering plants. The pale of the body is ascetic to its core. No pain, no gain. Altered states that arise within ourselves via internal catalysts like prayer and meditation are considered stable, reliable, and earned. If the goal is genuine transformation, then nothing as fleeting or pleasant as a flow state or psychedelic session can substitute for decades of prayer and meditation. The ultimate wisdom of enlightenment, author Sam Harris emphasized in his recent bestseller, Waking Up, whatever it is, cannot be a matter of having fleeting experiences. Peak experiences are fine, but real freedom must be coincident with normal waking life. In other words, insights gleaned from within the skin bag are valid and true, while those glimpsed outside the skin bag are not to be trusted. Experiences that require external catalysts, such as psychedelics and smart drugs, are volatile, unreliable, and ultimately, too easy. In 1962, attempting to settle this skin bag debate, Walter Pahnke conducted one of the more famous psychedelic experiments in history. A graduate student in theology at Harvard Divinity School, Pahnke gathered a group of 20 seminary students at Boston University's Marsh Chapel on Good Friday to see if mind-altering drugs could produce authentic mystical experiences. He gave half the group psilocybin, the other half the active placebo niacin, which produces similar physiological changes without the cognitive effects. Then everyone went into chapel to attend the Good Friday service. Afterward, subjects rated the service for a variety of mystical qualities: sacredness, ineffability, distortion of time and space, and a sense of oneness with the divine. Psilocybin subjects ranked their experiences much higher in mystical qualities than members of the control group did, explains John Horgan in his book Rational Mysticism. 6 months later, the psilocybin group reported persistent beneficial effects on their attitude and behavior. The experience had deepened their religious faith. The experiment was widely hailed as proof that psychedelic drugs can generate life-enhancing mystical experiences. So life-enhancing, in fact, that 9 out of the 10 seminary students who received psilocybin ended up becoming ministers, while none of the placebo group stayed on the path to ordination. Yet the skin bag bias has been hard to shake. Despite coming from a tightly controlled study at one of the nation's top institutions, these findings didn't do much to alter popular opinion or academic consensus. Researchers have twice gone back to validate Pankey's work. In 2002, Johns Hopkins psychopharmacologist Roland Griffiths got the same results when he reran the experiment with full, double-blind modern standards. When author Michael Pollan asked him about this unusual need for redundancy in a 2015 New Yorker article, Griffiths's answer said it all. There is such a sense of authority that comes out of the primary mystical experience that it can be threatening to existing hierarchical structures. We end up demonizing these compounds. Can you think of another area of science regarded as so dangerous and taboo that all research gets shut down for decades? It's unprecedented in modern science. Yet it's important to remember that the skin bag bias isn't simply about our distrust of pharmacology, whether study drugs or psychedelics. It's really about our distrust of technology in general. That was cyborg philosopher Andy Clark's point. And since consciousness-altering technology is changing fast, these developments are bringing up new test cases for what we consider legitimately earned ecstasis. Consider Laurentian University neuroscientist Michael Persinger's God Helmet. More than 50 years ago, researchers discovered that electrical stimulation of the right temporal lobe can produce visions of God, sensed presences, and other notable altered states. Persinger built a helmet that directs electromagnetic pulses toward this brain region. More than 2,000 people have tried out the device, and the majority have had some form of non-ordinary experience. Already, commercial versions of the God Helmet are available online, as are stories of DIY hackers who are reproducing its basic effects with little more than some wires and a 9-volt battery. There's talk about developing a version for virtual reality and incorporating it in video games. Other researchers are pushing neurotech even further. Palo Alto Neuroscience, a Silicon Valley startup, has developed a system that can tag the biomarkers of a non-ordinary state, that is, brain waves, heart rate variability, and galvanic skin response, and then use neurofeedback to guide you back there later. Trained meditators like Tibetan monks can put themselves into a transcendental state, and the machine will record their profile. Soon, as the technology matures, a novice will be able to put on the device and use these biomarkers to steer toward the same experience. But if we continue to insist that smart drugs and psychedelics are cheating, what happens as the boundaries between ourselves and our tools continue to blur? As technological upgrades and modifications to our inner state become increasingly common, what happens to the pale of the body when whole swatches of the populace begin finding God in the machine? The Pale of the State. In 2008, a middle-aged woman walked into David Nutt's office in Bristol, England. Nutt is a psychiatrist and psychopharmacologist specializing in the treatment of brain trauma, and this woman was in need of help. A serious head injury had caused a dramatic shift in her personality. She'd completely lost the ability to feel pleasure, becoming impulsive, anxious, and occasionally violent. Things had gotten so bad that she could no longer work, her children had been placed into foster care, and even her local pub had had enough, banning her for life after she'd begun abusing the staff. Nutt was no stranger to serious head trauma, but most of the cases he saw involved drug abuse. This woman didn't use drugs. Her injury had been sustained while horseback riding. Like most people, Nutt had assumed that horseback riding was a safe, outdoorsy pastime. Yet when he checked the data, he was surprised to discover the sport produced serious injury or death in one out of every 350 outings. At the time, Nutt was also the chair of the British Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. Part of his job involved assessing and ranking the harms of various substances and reporting those findings to the government and the public. As this was the late 2000s, the substance then getting the most attention was MDMA. Fueled by the rave scene, the drug had spread across England like wildfire. The press had been talking about it in epidemic terms. Politicians were vilifying it as public enemy number one. Nutt wasn't so sure. After meeting that woman, he'd done a back-of-the-envelope calculation comparing the injuries and deaths caused by horseback riding, which he dubbed equacy, to those produced by MDMA. But even when he discounted the downstream costs of drug use, such as addiction, violent behavior, and traffic accidents, his numbers showed the dangers of equacy and ecstasy several orders of magnitude apart. For every 60 million tablets of MDMA consumed, Nutt found 10,000 adverse events, or one for every 6,000 pills popped. He then compared that number to the 1 in 350 tally for horseback riding and published the results. Headlines across the country read, "British policy doctor claims ecstasy is safer than riding a horse." Tabloids had a field day. The internet picked up the story, and soon both houses of parliament were hotly debating the topic. Within a week, Nutt was called before the Home Secretary, somewhere between the U.S. Attorney General and the head of Homeland Security, and was publicly chastised for his irresponsible and incendiary remarks. Yet for Nutt, what he was saying wasn't incendiary. It was simply the facts. Ecstasy is a harmful drug, he explained in his 2012 bestseller, Drugs Without the Hot Air. But how harmful? As harmful as drinking 5 pints of beer? As harmful as riding a motorbike? David Spiegelhalter, a professor of risk communications at Cambridge University, has calculated that taking an ecstasy pill is as dangerous as riding a motorbike for about 6 miles or a pedal bike for 20 miles. These sorts of comparisons are useful because they can help people make choices about their behavior based on realistic assessments of the risks. Politicians, however, are highly resistant to them. And that's putting it mildly. Consider this Abbott and Costello-like who's-on-first exchange between Nutt and the Home Secretary. Home Secretary, you can't compare harms from an illegal activity with a legal one. Nutt, why not? Home Secretary, because one's illegal. Nutt, why is it illegal? Home Secretary, because it's harmful. Nutt, don't we need to compare harms to determine if it should be illegal? Home Secretary, you can't compare harms from an illegal activity with a legal one. After the hearing, it was clear to Nutt that the British government wasn't interested in data-driven comparisons. But that calculation had got him thinking. He decided to assess 20 of the most common substances of abuse for 9 different categories of harm, including physical, mental, and social impact. A quick scan of Nutt's evidence-based rankings confirm what many would suspect. On the list of toxic substances, drugs like heroin, crack, and methamphetamine rank high. No question about it, they're really bad for you, and really bad for those around you. But while heroin is so destructive that it claims the number 2 slot, it still couldn't beat out the number 1 scourge, alcohol. And tobacco, another legal staple of modern life, clocked in at number 6, 2 ahead of marijuana, and just behind cocaine and methamphetamine. And what about MDMA, that supposed public enemy number 1? It barely made the list, coming in at number 17, just ahead of LSD and magic mushrooms, which were 18 and 20, respectively. So while those substances are arguably our most feared drugs, when Nutt examined the facts, they weren't even close to the most harmful. Nutt told the public about this work in a lecture at King's College, London. This time, the combination of the sensational subject matter and the media's endless appetite for top 10 lists created the perfect viral storm. Everyone from The Guardian to The Economist picked up the story. The press crunched the data down to a headline. Government minister claims alcohol more dangerous than LSD. Nutt was back on the hot seat. This time it was too hot. A Home Office spokesman told the public, "The Home Secretary expressed surprise and disappointment over Professor Nutt's comments, which damage efforts to give the public a clear message about the dangers of drugs." A few days later, Nutt was relieved of his drug czar post, forever becoming the scientist who got sacked. But this does raise an important question. Why did Nutt lose his job? After all, he'd been hired to provide an evidence-based message about the harmfulness of drugs and had done just that. In fact, he'd done such solid work that The Lancet, one of the most reputable medical journals in the world, published his findings. But the issue had nothing to do with the quality of his research. Nutt had transgressed a different barrier, the pale of the state. In very simple terms, the states of consciousness we prefer are those that reinforce established cultural values. We enshrine these states socially, economically, and legally. That is, we have state-sanctioned states of consciousness. Altered states that subvert these values are persecuted, while the people who enjoy them are marginalized. Take Ritalin and Adderall, the ADHD meds that students as young as grade school pop like candy. These drugs don't even make an appearance on Nutt's list, while methamphetamines claim a top five spot. But they're essentially the same substance. Aside from some foul cutting material, explains journalist Alexander Zaitchik in Vice, Winnebago methamphetamine and pharmaceutical amphetamine are kissing cousins. The difference between them boils down to one methyl group that lets crank race a little faster across the blood-brain barrier and kick just a little harder. After that, meth breaks down fast into good old dextroamphetamine, the dominant salt in America's ADHD and CRAM study aid, Adderall. Yet our attitudes toward these substances, their inside or outside the pale status, is markedly different. The 1.2 million Americans who tried meth last year were Breaking Bad, while the 4.4 million American children who took ADHD drugs were striving to become better students. Same drugs, different contexts. One is manufactured by major pharmaceutical companies and enthusiastically dispensed by suburban doctors. The other is cooked up in trailers and sold on street corners. Or consider three substances that sit squarely inside the state's pale: caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol. The coffee break, smoke break, and happy hour are the most culturally enshrined drug rituals of the modern era, even though two of the three are top 10 offenders in Nutt's rankings. There's hardly a single workplace in the Western world that doesn't, at least informally, support this triad, and for good reason. An optimally tuned market economy needs alert employees who work as hard as possible for as long as possible. So dedicated timeouts for stimulant consumption, that is, the coffee break, and these days the e-cigarette break, are institutionally sanctioned and socially reinforced, which is where the cocktails come in. Without the soothing effects of alcohol, the cigarettes and coffee workforce would become jittery wrecks within a fortnight. Add in some booze from time to time, and you've got a finely tuned cycle of stimulation, focus, decompression that dovetails with broader economic goals. In the competitive environment of the firm, explains Intel researcher and author Melissa Gregg in The Atlantic, it is little wonder that workers resort to performance-enhancing drugs. When so many jobs require social networking to maintain employability, these mood enhancers are a natural complement to the workday after 5 p.m. In an always-on world, professional credibility involves a judicious mix of just the right amount of uppers and downers to remain charming. Because these substances drive us forward, they continue to sit inside society's perimeter fence, and never mind the evidence. And that fence is the real reason Nutt lost his job. Even though the information he presented was considered medical and factual, it went against established norms and policies. It threatened approved channels of awareness and the substances that support them. Nutt ventured beyond the pale of the state and ended up, professionally, burned at the stake. Pipers, cults, and commies. Hamelin is a town of about 50,000 people, nestled among the rolling hills of central Germany. The buildings are timber-framed sandstone, the lanes are narrow and winding, the beer gardens are cozy. And then there are the rats. In Hamelin, the rats are everywhere. In photos, on paintings, depicted in the stained glass of the town's 800-year-old church, all the bakeries sell them. Rat-shaped cakes, cupcakes, and loaves of bread. They're available as keepsakes and keychains. They are the town's most famous citizens. Their tale dates back 1,000 years, retold by Goethe, the Brothers Grimm, and the poet Robert Browning, a warning to parents and children alike. According to the Lüneburg manuscript, the only written account of the actual event, in 1284, Hamelin was suffering a rodent infestation. That's when a wandering minstrel with a magic flute showed up. He claimed to be a rat catcher, willing to rid the town of its problem, but for a fee. The locals agreed to his price, and the piper went to work. He played his flute and entranced the rats. They followed him wherever he went, out of the town's main gates, down to the river, and into the water, where, unable to break free from the power of the music, they drowned. It was a job well done. The issue was the fee. The locals refused to pay the piper, so he stormed off, vowing revenge. A few months later he returned, but this time, when he played his flute, it wasn't the rats who followed, it was the children. The citizens of Hamelin recorded their loss in their town register, afterward dating all proclamations according to the years and the days since the tragedy. Even today, the Hamelin Town Hall still bears the inscription. In the year 1284, after the birth of Christ, from Hamelin were led away 130 children born at this place, led away by a piper into a mountain. Historians continue to debate the tale of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Early interpretations held that the rats were a carrier of plague, and this was an outbreak story. Others have argued it was a tale of forced conscription and a children's crusade. A few scholars have focused on a singular detail, that magic flute whose tune none can resist, and argued this might actually be a story about the irresistible attraction of music, dance, and trance, against which a stern medieval church could not compete. So while we usually tell the Pied Piper story as a morality play, a reminder to pay your debts and keep your word, it might actually be a warning about the lure of ecstasy. This is no idle warning. History is littered with tales of ecstatic explorations gone wrong. Consider the 1960s. Ken Kesey snuck LSD out of a Stanford research lab, and all manner of tie-dyed hell broke loose. The same thing happened with the sexual revolution of the 1970s. What began as a quest for personal liberation ended up in spiking rates of marital dissatisfaction and divorce. And 1990s rave culture, too, which blended synthetic drugs with electronic music, collapsed under a series of tightening legal restrictions, ER visits, and tabloid fodder. Which brings us to the final reason the Stealing Fire Revolution has remained hidden from view. Nearly every time we light out into this terrain, somebody gets lost. By definition, ecstasy makes for tricky navigation. The term means out of our heads, and out isn't always pleasant. These states can be destabilizing. It's why psychologists use terms like ego death to describe the experiences. It's a sense of total annihilation, writes psychiatrist Stanislav Grof in his book, The Adventure of Self-Discovery. This experience of ego death seems to entail an instant, merciless destruction of all previous reference points in the life of an individual. In short, Alice didn't wander into Wonderland. She fell down the rabbit hole. Making matters worse, these experiences are enticing. Sometimes we revisit them more often than we should. The $4 trillion of the altered state's economy is a stark testament to the depth of that desire. So while we've painted the guardians of the pale in a somewhat reactionary light, let's give the gatekeepers their due. What lies beyond the pale isn't always safe and secure. Outside the fence of state-sanctioned consciousness, there are, to be sure, peaks of profound insight and inspiration. But there are also the swamps of addiction, superstition, and groupthink, where the unprepared can get stuck. For this reason, most people don't venture outside alone. We look for others who have gone this way before us. We look for guidance and for leadership. But, as the Pied Piper story illustrates, not everyone who leads us beyond that fence has our best intentions at heart. This past century was thick with cautionary tales. Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and his bioterrorist followers, Marshall Applewhite and the Heaven's Gate suicides, and Charles Manson and the Tate-LaBianca murders are well-known examples. There are plenty of others. Combine enticing experiences with clay-footed gurus, and you have a recipe for disaster. No wonder parents of the 1960s hugged their children close as they traipsed off to California, or Bali, or Maui, with flowers in their hair. There really was no telling if the next enlightened sage was a huckster, a demagogue, or both. Better to never venture out the door than roll those dice. Isn't that why Harvard professor Timothy Leary, whose greatest crime was telling undergrads to tune in, turn on, and drop out, ended up branded by President Richard Nixon the most dangerous man in America? And it's not just the unscrupulousness of leaders. It's the power of the tools they wield. During ecstasis, our sense of being an individual I gets replaced by the feeling of being a collective we. And this doesn't just happen in small groups like the SEALs on night ops or Googlers at a desert festival. It's also the feeling that arises at large political rallies, rock concerts, and sporting events. It's one of the reasons people go on spiritual pilgrimages, and why evangelical megachurches are booming, with more than 6 million attendees every Sunday. Bring a large group of people together, deploy a suite of mind-melding technologies, and suddenly, everyone's consciousness is doing the wave. Communitas is the term University of Chicago anthropologist Victor Turner used to describe this ecstatic sense of unity. This feeling tightens social bonds and ignites enduring passion, the kind that lets us come together to plan, organize, and tackle great challenges. But it's a double-edged sword. When we lose ourselves and merge with a group, we are in danger of losing too much of ourselves. Our cherished, rational individualism risks being overrun by the power of irrational collectivism. This is how the ideals of the French Revolution veered into the bloody mob rule of the Reign of Terror. It's why, Turner argued, communitas is too potent to unleash without proper checks and balances. Exaggerations of communitas in certain religious or political movements of the leveling type may be speedily followed by despotism. In the 1930s, Adolf Hitler provided a frightening example, co-opting traditional techniques of ecstasy, light, sound, chanting, movement, for his Nuremberg rallies. I am beginning to comprehend some of the reasons for Hitler's astounding success, wrote Hearst journalist William Shirer in 1934. Borrowing a chapter from the Roman Church, he's restoring pageantry and mysticism to the drab lives of 20th century Germans. Hitler wasn't just borrowing from Rome, but from the United States as well. According to Führerkonfidant Ernst Hanfstengel, the Sieg Heil used in political rallies was a direct copy of the technique used by American college football cheerleaders. American college-type music was used to excite the German masses who had been used to dry-as-dust political lectures. Hitler wasn't the only 20th-century despot to rely on these techniques. Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot sold the same thing, a utopia of we, the experience of communitas at scale. They even sold it the same way. Nearly identical stump speeches. Individualism is out. We are all one. No one is better than anyone else. Anyone who disagrees will either be shot, imprisoned, or rehabilitated. As Nietzsche said, madness is rare in individuals, but in groups, political parties, nations, and eras, it's the rule. And in ecstatic groups, it's practically unavoidable. So why have we missed a revolution in human possibility? Because altered states have a distinctly checkered history of altering nation-states. Because pipers, cults, and commies scare the pants off us. Because the drive to get out of our heads has ended in tragedy as often as ecstasy. Because the Pale protects us as much as it confines us. Because no one wants to end up like the children of Hamelin, lured beyond the safety of the town walls, never to be heard from again. Part 2. The Four Forces of Ecstasis. No one dances sober unless he is insane. Cicero. Chapter 4. Psychology. Translating Transformation. In the Middle Ages, priests routinely complained that their congregants nodded off in church. Still, despite the stuffy pews and unintelligible sermons, parishioners made sure they were awake for the most interesting part of the service, the miraculous transformation of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. At that exact moment, the priest would utter a powerful incantation, what sounded like hocus pocus, and the magic would be done. Except, as Archbishop of Canterbury John Tillotson later noted, in all probability, hocus pocus is nothing else but a corruption of hoc est corpus, this is the body, a ridiculous imitation of the priests of the church. Without the ability to understand Latin, the peasants had garbled the translation, providing would-be magicians with a catchphrase for centuries to come. But in 1439, Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press, giving the faithful the chance to read the Bible in their own language. Rather than deferring to the clergy, lay people could suddenly debate and interpret scriptures and draw their own conclusions. This broke the church's hold on Renaissance Europe and paved the way for reformations and revolutions. Something similar is happening today. Thanks to accelerating developments in four fields, psychology, neurobiology, pharmacology, and technology, call them the four forces of ecstasis, we're getting greater access to and understanding of non-ordinary states of consciousness. These forces give us the chance to study, debate, reject, and revise long-standing beliefs of our own. We're becoming more precise in our translations, learning to rely less on hocus-pocus and superstition, and more on science and experience. Advances in psychology have given us a better sense of our own development, and with it, the space to move beyond socially defined identity. Stepping outside the monkey suits of our waking selves no longer means risking ridicule or madness. Higher stages of personal development have been demystified. We now have the data-driven models needed to navigate this formerly obscure terrain and clearer frameworks to make sense of the journey. Advances in neurobiology, meanwhile, have clarified our understanding of what is happening in our brains and bodies when we experience a range of mental states. This sharpened perspective allows us to strip out the interpretations of past gatekeepers and understand, in simple and rational terms, the mechanics of transcendence. And unlike the take-it-on-faith dictates of traditional mythologies, the discoveries of neurobiology are testable. Pharmacology gives us another tool to explore this terrain. By treating the six powerful neurochemicals that underpin ecstasy as raw ingredients, we've begun to refine the recipes for peak experience. We're translating the cookbook for Kaikian, allowing us to tune these states with increasing precision and giving us access to them on demand. Our last force, technology, brings that access to scale. Whether we're relying on flow-producing neurofeedback or awe-inducing virtual reality, these breakthroughs turn once solitary epiphanies into experiences that can be shared by hundreds of thousands of people at once. More people having more experiences means more data and firmer conclusions. Combined, these forces give us unprecedented insight into the upper range of human experience. In part two of this book, we're going to examine them in detail, seeing where they come from and why they matter. We'll meet the innovators and experts at the forefront of this movement, an unlikely collection of digital artists, consciousness hackers, sex therapists, and molecular chemists, to name a few, who are harnessing these four forces to drive change in the real world. By democratizing access to some of the more controversial and misunderstood territory in history, these modern-day Gutenbergs are taking experiences once reserved for mystics and making them available to the masses. The bell tolls for thee. In February 2009, Oprah Winfrey teamed up with Eckhart Tolle for Oprah and Eckhart, A New Earth, a 10-part online video series devoted to Tolle's non-traditional ideas about spirituality. 11 million people from 139 different countries tuned in to watch. Global brands, Chevy, Skype, and Post-it sponsored the series. A New Earth attracted 10 million people, or 800,000 more than turned up in New York City for the Pope's last visit, and 9 million more than the largest Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca, on record, making this webcast one of the 10 largest spiritual gatherings in recorded history. Yet Tolle remains an unusual candidate for guru of the century. He grew up in the rubble of post-war Germany, suffering acute anxiety and severe depression. By age 10, he was contemplating suicide. By age 29, while a doctoral candidate in philosophy at the University of Cambridge, he snapped. Tolle dropped out of graduate school and spent the next 2 years homeless, mostly sitting on a park bench in central London. He passed the time in a state of near-constant bliss, a state of oneness with the universe that he maintains persists to this day. In spiritual terms, Eckhart Tolle found sudden enlightenment. In the language of this book, he stabilized ecstasy, making the temporary, selfless, timeless, and effortless experience of a non-ordinary state a part of his permanent reality. But go back a decade or two, and traditional psychiatrists might have assessed his case very differently. Tolle would have been kept in a padded cell, sedated with Thorazine, and given a steady dose of electroshock therapy. Instead, he teamed up with Oprah to beam his unassuming talk of non-dual consciousness out to millions of seekers around the world. What Tolle is preaching is nothing less than the gospel of stir. His core argument is that through the experience of selflessness, timelessness, and effortlessness, his so-called power of now, we can dwell in a place of unlimited richness. And if the popularity of his webcast is anything to go by, this idea is resonating with millions of people. Which brings us to an important question. How did any of this happen? How did we get from a man who would have been institutionalized as clinically insane a few decades ago to where we are today, with the same man leading one of the largest spiritual gatherings in history? To answer this question, we'll need to understand how psychology became a force for ecstasis. We'll start with origin stories, seeing how the human potential movement broadened the vocabulary of inner experience and then brought that vocabulary to the mainstream. A glimpse under the covers of a 21st century sexual revolution will explore how an expanding menu of acceptable practices has given more people access to non-ordinary states than ever. We'll then examine how researchers are using peak experiences to cure trauma in terminal patients and survivors of abuse and war. Finally, we'll see how scientists have begun to integrate ideas about ecstasy into a rigorous model of human psychology that shows altered states don't just make us feel better for a moment, they can actually further our development over a lifetime. But before we can do any of that, we have to turn back the calendar some 70 years and meet ourselves as we once were. Mad Men. Coming out of World War II, our concept of self, of who we actually were, didn't stretch very far. With the cardboard cutouts of Organization Man on one side and Betty Homemaker on the other, our sense of ourselves was constricted almost to the point of caricature. Hollywood stars like Gary Cooper and John Wayne epitomized a strong and silent masculine ideal, while soap operas and advertisements sold a flawless stay-at-home femininity. This was the era of the man in the gray flannel suit, when suburban conformity, consumerism, and corporate ladder climbing had come to signify success. But all this started to change in the late 1950s, as the Beat's passionate rebellion found its voice. The Beat Generation was a vision that we had, explained Jack Kerouac in Aftermath, of a generation of crazy, illuminated hipsters suddenly rising and roaming America, characters of a special spirituality staring out the dead wall window of our civilization. Allen Ginsberg's epic poem Howl was a shout-out that same window, a free-verse rant about the need to break loose from social constraint via direct, primal experience. Nowhere did this urge for raw self-expression show up more visibly than at Esalen, the Big Sur, California-based institute that the New York Times once called the Harvard of the human potential movement. So central was Esalen to the evolving identity of that generation that the popular TV show Mad Men ended with its main character Don Draper experiencing an epiphany on its oceanside front lawn, and as a harbinger of the spiritual marketplace that would soon emerge, he promptly turned that insight into the iconic "I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke" ad campaign. While histories of Esalen tend to focus on founder Michael Murphy, whose family had owned that idyllic stretch of California coastline for generations, the path that led to Eckhart on Oprah was largely laid by Dick Price, Esalen's co-founder and first director. In 1952, Price came out of Stanford with a degree in psychology and went to Harvard for graduate school, but, frustrated by the conservatism of the faculty, dropped out. He moved to San Francisco, bumped into the Beats, and under their tutelage began exploring Eastern mysticism and primal experience. Shaken loose from his moorings, Price suffered a manic episode at a North Beach, San Francisco bar in 1956 and was hauled off for a 3-month stint on an army psych ward. While the state labeled him psychotic, Price didn't accept that he had gone crazy. He labeled his unhinging a transitional psychosis and argued that his time on the ward served a useful purpose, unlocking a door within himself. "My so-called psychosis," Price later said, "was an attempt toward spontaneous healing, and it was a movement toward health, not a movement toward disease." Price's realization, the idea that we sometimes have to break down to break through, quickly became a mainstay of the human potential movement. It's one of the reasons we can now view Tolle's Park Bench Madness as a spiritual initiation rather than as a psychological meltdown. Over the next 2 decades, Price and Murphy evolved this insight into a pragmatic philosophy. they took the best that organized religion had to offer, stripped out anything that was doctrinal or impractical, and placed a heavy emphasis on ecstatic experimentation. It was a pragmatic culture of sensation and know-how, notes author and modern religious historian Eric Davis in Afterburn, an essentially empirical approach to matters of the spirit that made tools more important than beliefs. Consciousness-altering techniques like meditation, biofeedback, yoga, ritual, isolation tanks, tantric sex, breathwork, martial arts, group dynamics, and drugs were privileged over the claustrophobic structures of authority and belief that were seen to define conventional religion. It was a uniquely American approach that resonated deeply with the country's anti-authoritarian ideals. Rice University religious scholar Jeff Krippal called it the religion of no religion, writing in his book Esalen, "It has no official alliance with any religious system. It can provide, like a kind of American mystical constitution, a spiritual space where almost any religious form can flourish, provided that it does not claim to speak for everyone." As an early Esalen motto put it, "No one captures the flag." Despite its inclusive charter, the Institute's impact was limited to a thin slice of the population. With its deep roots in Ivy League intellectualism and ascetic Eastern mysticism, this new philosophy mainly attracted well-educated freethinkers from New England and California. That is, until Werner Erhard came along and transplanted Esalen's esoteric ideas out of Bohemia and into the belly of the mainstream. Erhard, a self-educated car salesman from St. Louis, was drawn to personal development through his study of motivation. He quickly realized that many of the ideas of the human potential movement had applications beyond spiritual seeking. So Erhard repackaged an assortment of Esalen-inspired practices into a business-friendly format, creating EST, short for the Erhard Seminars Training. The seminar deliberately reproduced Price's accidental transformation, engineering a breakdown-to-breakthrough experience via a series of marathon, 14-hour days, without food or breaks, and with lots of yelling and profanity, the fabled EST encounter. Prior to Erhard, most spiritual seekers skewed anti-establishment and anti-materialist, which is fine if you're living in a monastery or off a trust fund, but problematic if you need to make a living, and even more problematic if you're trying to sell seminars. In the same way that Henry Ford realized his workers had to be able to afford one of his Model Ts for his company to thrive, Erhard understood that seekers needed to be financially successful enough to afford his next workshop. So he hitched the human potential movement to the wagon of the Protestant work ethic. Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich replaced the Bhagavad Gita as seminal text. Mandalas were out, vision boards were in, and the American spiritual marketplace has never been the same. If you've ever hired a personal or executive coach, professions that didn't exist before the late 1970s, heard someone say they just needed space, been encouraged to take a stand or make a difference, or engaged in a journey of transformation around your personal story, you've come across terms coined or popularized by Erhard and his trainings. And with this expansion of vocabulary and emphasis on material success, what had been formerly other, that is, couched in the esoteric language of Asian religions and incompatible with the American dream, became us, part of our everyday vernacular, and accessible to all. While EST itself made an impact, with almost 1 million people going through those original seminars, Landmark, the latest incarnation of Erhard's teachings, boasts corporate clients including Microsoft, NASA, Reebok, and Lululemon. Personal development, which only a few decades ago had been mocked and marginalized, has become a credible way to optimize human capital at some of the country's most successful organizations. We hear echoes of these ideas everywhere, from Tony Robbins's empowerment seminars to the prosperity theology preached every Sunday by megachurch ministers like Joel Osteen. And even though Tolle's teachings stay remarkably grounded in